Following Pope Benedict XVI's resignation last week, I'm sitting here with the pastor of St. Margaret Mary Catholic Church, Father Dick Walsh, who will answer a few questions about what this means for the future of the papacy. Pope Benedict has said that he feels no longer capable of the tasks asked of him. Do you feel this shows weakness of the church or humility?
Maybe not weakness of the church, I think. Perhaps his own personal weakness at 85 years of age, and you could see recently that his strength is getting more diminished with the passage of time. So there's no way at the age of 85 that he could be an effective leader. So probably it's a combination of his own weakness on the one hand and his own humility on the other, that all of a sudden he realizes this job is too big for him, and so it's appropriate that he stepped down.
And if this opens the door for future members of the papacy to step down in this manner, do you feel that that type of route would ease the transition for a new conclave versus what we saw when Pope John Paul II was in failing health?
I think it would ease the transition. I think they have a little bit more time and they can do it in a more orderly manner than otherwise. So they have time to sort of get their ducks in a row.
And what makes someone eligible to become the Pope, traditionally?
Traditionally, it has been a cardinal. But the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, first and foremost. So obviously an archbishop or a bishop could technically become a Pope, but the chances of it happening are unlikely.
And what does the resigned Pope do now?
Well, it said the news reports this morning said that he's going to go into some kind of seclusion where he's not going to be in any sense of the word a public figure, but that I presume people can continue to meet him wherever he's going to reside. But I'm assuming he'd probably write if he's able.
And how would a new Pope affect St. Margaret Mary and its parishioners?
I think in the day-to-day life of the church, at least for the present, I can't say there'd be any major difference. The church is hierarchic, and so the local bishop pretty much helps set the agenda for the local church. So we're a long distance from Rome, so I think I can't foresee any major changes in the immediate future.
And is that a change from the past, where perhaps in past centuries the Pope would have a greater influence around the world in local areas?
I don't think so. I think the role of the Pope is too large to. In fact, perhaps today, because of modern communication, there's a possibility that his thoughts and ideas and his spirit can be communicated a lot more quickly nowadays than like 100 years ago.
And so does that mean that he has a greater impact today?
Well, I suppose in a certain sense, yes, to the extent that if you take the writings of Pope Benedict, he's written about three books that I think have been fairly popular, And I think also probably his proclamations, people are aware of them straight away, but have they made that much difference in the daily life of the church? Nothing immediate, I think, at least in the last several years.
Do you feel that Pope Benedict will have an influence on who's chosen to succeed him?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. He probably will have an influence to the extent that he has been responsible for the selection of many of the cardinals in the last 8 years. So to that extent, the people that have been selected in the last 8 years, they share sort of the same mindset that he shares. So to that extent, he would probably have perhaps a significant influence. Otherwise, I don't think so. But I mean, in terms of, it's not as if he's going to. I think he's a very faithful man. I don't think he's going to in any way try to usurp or influence the process. But I mean, the people who make that decision, so many of them are sort of his men.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And we thank Father Dick Walsh for joining us. And it still remains to be seen when the conclave will choose the new pope. But we will know and let you know when that happens.
So we're going to start you off with the first song of the hour. Something smooth, something to kind of get you in the mood for the day. It's Desiree's You Gotta Be.
Leads to a place that she thinks of as extraordinarily mysterious. Just what perked her imagination up. I think the fact that it's... Well, Florida's a very special and weird place. I've only lived here now for about 5 years, though I've been coming to Florida for about 12 or 13 years. And I can't even bear the East Coast. And so there are writers who write about the East Coast and finding it pretty unbearable, too, finding the make-believe that you certainly find in Central, but in South Florida, too. Elements of make-believe all through the culture. So very ripe to talk about.
Looking locally, what does Orlando's literary community offer something that no other location can? Is it your festival?
I'm not sure about that.
I'm not sure.
I think that writers in the Orlando community certainly find each other. There seems to be a critical mass of writers and a very active scene. Spoken word, for instance, there are community workshops, there are people gathering at other people's houses. I've never really lived in an area like this. I've always lived in suburbia. So I'm used to people barely knowing each other. And Karen Russell, again, who was just here, which is why I keep mentioning her, says she lives in Philadelphia, and she really has two writer friends. But in Orlando, there are writers upon writers. There's the Kerouac House. Just a really good scene.
Turning to a little bit of gossip, without mentioning any names, what makes an author... Or what have been some of the worst moments in Winter with the Writers? What makes a bad performance?
In terms of the reading, I think I haven't been disappointed at all. But probably a disappointment for me will be when the writer lacks the generosity to really engage with the students. Often that comes, and the writer goes off script. So even though there's an itinerary, even though the writer knows that the master class is 90 minutes and that they will be looking at student work, sometimes a writer will ignore that and launch into autobiographical rhapsody or telling jokes. Just part of the routine, the show of the writer.
And what writers and events can people look forward to for the remaining 2 weeks of the festival?
Well, we're going to have Azana Fisi. That'll be on the 28th. And she wrote the marvelous book. I think a lot of people on campus know it or have read it, Reading Lolita in Tehran. And next week, we're having a Cuban-American poet from Miami, Ricardo Paujosa, and the Puerto Rican-African writer, Mara Santos Febres. I think those are going to be three very lively writers. I think the classes will be good, and I think the readings will be good too.
All right, thanks for joining us, and I hope the rest of the festival is great.
Thank you too.
And thanks again to Carol Frost. And as for the rest of the festival, it will continue on Thursday, February. This upcoming Sunday is Oscar Sunday. Isn't that right, Amir?
Oscar fever, yes.
Yes. You got the Oscar fever?
I do have the Oscar fever. Out of all the award shows, this is my jam, as they would say. I love it. I love it. I love the pageantry. I love the hosts. Usually they have good hosts. Sometimes they don't. But obviously it's not just about that. It is about the movies. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and I've always been partial to the Oscars as well. Just, you name it. I mean, all the things that you named.
All the things, all the small things, all the big things. I'm very, very partial to this one. because of Argo. I'm very excited for Argo. Ben Affleck, John Goodman. I mean,
Iran.
Yes, all of that. I mean, it's such a good story. It's amazing. It was kind of slow. People weren't like, they didn't know if it was going to be as good, if it would kind of really put the heat on with films like Lincoln or Zero Dark Thirty, you know, a lot of these other films, but it's really held its own. It has really held its own.
Yes, and we're also joined by Rachel Fallowshare. What do you, if you do, enjoy the Oscars?
Well, I technically would say I'm a little more music person, so, you know, my jam, if you will. Good morning, everyone, by the way. Yep, you might remember me as Rachel Jesse. But, so the Grammys happened, and I thought it was phenomenal. But I am stoked about the Oscars because film is fantastic, and, all the various reasons y'all named make it great. And, of course, the usual red carpet deal and seeing all the wonderful ensembles are great. I'm stoked about just, Lincoln, and a lot of people have talked about Django Unchained, etc. So we'll see.
So stop me if either of you have seen any of these. Amour?
Okay, I haven't seen No.
Life of Pi?
No.
I want to see that. I keep hearing great things.
Silver Linings Playbook?
I haven't seen that one either.
Les Mis?
Yes, I have seen that.
Yes, I saw that as well. I thought that was very good.
I enjoyed it.
Django Unchained?
I have seen Django Unchained.
I did
that
as well.
That is really good.
It was really good.
I want to see it. I have yet.
Beasts of the Southern Wild?
I've seen that. Mm-hmm. I was going to name it.
I really want to see that.
It's great. It's interesting, to say the least.
Lincoln?
Believe it or not, have yet to see it.
Zero Dark Thirty?
No, not yet.
Negative.
That was good.
Yeah?
Yeah. Argo?
Argo!
Of course.
Argo.
Yeah.
Yes, I might have glanced over that once or twice.
Mm-hmm. So, what's, I guess maybe we know Amir's pick.
Yeah.
From the ones you've seen, Rachel, which do you think stood out and should deserve it? These are the best picture nominees.
Right.
Listeners.
You know, it's so difficult. I was talking with a friend. I kind of wish he was here because he sounds very knowledgeable and he'd answer this question a lot better. It's interesting, the mix. And, you know, first of all, there are a lot more nominees now, you know, nods in this category than in the past. And part of that, he felt, had to do, I'll shout his name, I guess, Jamin Shepherd, is because you, in these times, if you will, you're starting to see a lot more kind of personalities of people and cultures having opportunities to make films, and thus, you know, people seeing them. So it's great to see that. And I don't know, like, because I'm even trying to compare the two that I've seen out of the list there, and I'm like, they're so different. So it'd be like, oh, how do I pick best picture out of those two and all the things that the Academy take into account to decide? I'm really not sure. I'd have to think about it a little bit more.
Right, and that is difficult. And you see the Golden Globes try to take that on by having separate categories for drama and musical and comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Oscars, you see Les Mis up against Argo, against Django.
Right.
And these other films. And I guess we could segue into Best Actor.
Mm.
Perhaps we've seen a couple of these between us. One that perhaps slipped under people's radar was Denzel Washington in Flight, which I thought was fantastic. A friend of mine actually dragged me to see it twice, and so I'm very familiar with it.
Nice.
And really, he does a phenomenal job portraying this character, and it's really, I would say, unlike any other role he's had before as this maligned pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, out of the other films, I suppose Hugh Jackman in Les Mis is our other...
Yes!
Person from films that we've seen.
he rocked it, though, I gotta say. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed. I was like, oh, you got pipes, too. Look at you. I've only, you know, really familiar with you more in Wolverine. So this
right.
is quite a different role for you. Good job.
Yeah, he was phenomenal. I know Anne Hathaway is up for Best Supporting Actress. She was incredible in the time that she was there.
Yes, yes. I was looking at the wrong category. Yes, best supporting actress.
And then leading actress, we have the star of Beasts of the Southern Wild. I don't think I'll be able to pronounce her name correctly. But I believe we all know who we're talking about.
I assume the girl, the little girl.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was like, wow. It's again, I don't want to use something that seems so bland as the adjective interesting, because I can't really find a better word for, you know, it was one of those movies at the end of it. I was kind of like trying to process everything and how I felt, you know. There was like a bit of like a joy, and then like, oh, that was almost bizarre. And also like, you know, I love really like various kinds of art, and even things that are just, you know, avant-garde, if you will. This doesn't fall in that category, but I just mean, I don't mind things being really bizarre or like, you know, just out of the norm, if you will. I just had a lot of different emotions with it. So that to say, I was very impressed with that, you know, young actress.
And she's up against Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty, who's probably the favorite coming from her win at the Golden Globes. And she played an immensely strong character who is witness to some of the alleged torture that goes on in the Middle East, that tries to attain different levels of intelligence in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and that definitely would be deserved if she were to win. And then moving on to a little bit about our host, which was an unconventional choice.
Yes, Seth MacFarlane. I mean, obviously, you know, Oscars is always trying to find that line between somebody who's edgy and then somebody who plays it safe, depending on the year. I know that after Chris Rock, who rocked it out, I mean, awesome host.
No pun intended.
No pun at all. he got into slack with some of his Jude Law comments and whatnot, and they decided for a little while to get a little bit safer, and I think now the tide's somewhat turning, and they want somebody a little bit edgy and a little, you know, funny. And I think Seth MacFarlane has hosted other gigs. I can't remember what specifically.
I'm not sure.
But I mean, I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see, say the least, to see how he does, and if he decides to do. I don't think he's going to do a safe performance, so it'll be interesting to see how far he goes.
Yeah, I'm like, he writes Family Guy.
The safe performance in recent years has come from Billy Crystal, who, yeah, I think is worn out his welcome a little bit.
Yeah,
I don't know. Last year I thought was a little flat.
Yeah,
and then that was coming off of the year before when two actors were hosting it. Not to say that Billy Crystal or Seth MacFarlane are not actors, but two strictly film actors in Anne Hathaway and James Franco. Which, what did you think of that?
James.
I mean, it was very, I feel like that was very hit and miss as well. Like, some skits were like, ah, you know, it's actually kind of funny. And in other words, it's just like, just coming to the next category. I'm sorry,
right.
James Franco, Anne Hathaway. I can't do it. It's like, it's 10:30. Just like me through the rest of the award show.
Right. Many people thought that James was a bust, but the parts I saw, I really loved. Like when Anne Hathaway reminds him that he's up for an Oscar, and he says, what do I get if I win? She's saying, the prestige and the award, and everyone has to call you Academy Award winner James Franco. He says, so, even my mom? That'd be kind of weird. I've known her a long time. And so people thought that his like aloofness and sort of understated performance was a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But I thought it really brought something interesting to the show and sort of subverted what the Oscars is traditionally about.
That's true. That's hilarious.
And so we definitely look forward to Sunday night and with anticipation.
Anticipation.
Yay.
Now we're going to move to our next segment, our next interview, regarding Kevin Gray. Kevin Gray taught at Rollins for 2 years as a visiting professor of theater and music and director of Cabaret, Grease, and the opera Hansel and Gretel. He passed on Monday, February 11th, of a heart attack at the age of 54 and is survived by his wife, Dodie Pettit. Most remembering him from his Broadway performances, including Jesus Christ Superstar and The King and I, and as the title role of Phantom in the Opera. Alexis Riley remembers the effect he had on her life, which she shared with us before. I'm speaking with Alexis Riley, senior in the theater department with a music minor and one of the associate artistic directors of Rollins Improv Players. Thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me.
So today we were going to talk about Kevin Gray, who was a former visiting professor of theater and music. So my first question is, who is Kevin Gray to you?
Kevin was that one professor that I think everyone in their college experience has one or two professors that they sort of just attach themselves to and who really profoundly impact the course of their college career. And for me, he was definitely that person. His first year at Rollins was my first year at Rollins. And I was on a directing track, actually. I had a really bad experience in high school being told by different directors and people at my school that, oh, you know, you're never going to make it and you're not very good, so you should just quit while you're ahead. I had one teacher tell me that she said, you're too smart to be an actor, so you should be a director, which is now, like, probably about the most offensive thing you could probably say. So I came to college sort of in that place of self-deprecation almost. But I couldn't leave the theater, so I decided, well, if I can't be on stage, maybe I can be around the stage. Because I was on directing track. And second semester of my sophomore year, I had heard the Phantom of the Opera was teaching acting for musical theater. And I don't know, it's like I wasn't ready to quite give up yet. So I just took it on a whim, sort of, and ended up in that class. And now I'm sitting as a performance major with a music minor, having been blessed with several opportunities to perform at school. And I know that those wouldn't have even happened had he not sort of just even, I think his greatest gift was listening, just listening to people.
Well, that leads to my next question. Were there any special quirks about him that made him so special to you and the other students at Rollins?
That's the thing. His life was very much a work of art. I feel like you could, in a sort of Warhol-esque cinematic stint of genius, film just an hour of his life, and you could probably sell tickets. He was not only an incredible listener, but the way he communicated, the way he told stories. Several of us have recordings from classes that we've had with him. Just the intent was so that when we were working on songs or something, we could go back and sort of listen to the notes that he gave us. But they've been rather comforting as of late. And just hearing the tenor of his voice and the degree of passion with which he spoke. He was the first person I've ever met who he would be talking to you and then you just suddenly burst into song to try to like make his point, and it was the most incredible thing because at first it was a little weird, but then you realize how effectively that communicated what he was saying. So everything Uta Hagen is an acting theorist who has this quote. She says I'm misquoting, but the gist is that theater should be both true to life and theatrical, and I think that very much describes how he was.
Why do you think there was such an outpouring of emotion over the news of his passing?
Well, I think in part it was very unexpected, but I also think he truly, I don't think this of every person, and I don't say this in a poetic way. I mean it in a very true way. Every single person he came into contact with on this campus was profoundly changed by him. I was talking to some of my friends earlier, because, you know, he even after he left to teach in Connecticut, I would every now and then send him, you know, an email or a Facebook message or something, and I always get a response the next day, really long. And when he was talking to you, you really truly felt like you were the only person in the world. And I think to some extent, I wonder if that's what talking to God feels like. You know, you don't have any awareness of anything but you at that moment. And but the thing is, I think I initially thought that that correspondence made me special in some way. But the more I talk to people, I think that is categorically true of everyone that he met, to the point of people he didn't have in class and just sort of knew tangentially. So I can say that he was very important in my life, but I think that that sentiment is shared equally and with equal degree by hundreds of people here.
Tell me a little bit about the Kevin Gray quote book.
So the Kevin Gray quote book is a project that Megan Ryan Gordon, who's also a senior theater major, has started, and he was particularly important to our senior theater class this year because we sort of started with him. He became the Robin Williams, "Oh Captain, My Captain," for our class. So something in the spirit of preserving these incredible lessons and I mean, even just funny things that he said or done that are really important and special to us, Megan is heading up this project to collect quotes and things of that nature from anyone who's come into contact with him, and so that we can write those down so we can share them with each other. And it's in part to preserve kind of those lessons and his memory, but I think it's also a way of sort of celebrating and bringing people together and sitting down and, you know, being able to laugh about stories and just kind of revel in the amazingness that is this person.
Finally, I hear that a memorial service is being planned.
That's correct. The memorial service the date has not been set, but it's currently being worked on by the theater department and several of the theater students. So that's going to be announced once it is planned. They're having a couple of speakers, some former students, a couple of musical selections that were his favorites, and things of that nature. And we're looking to incorporate anyone who knew him into the process, and so hopefully that will be happening soon.
Great. Thank you so much, Alexis, again for your time.
Thanks.
We're still awaiting word on when the memorial service will take place, although the information will appear on Rollins' calendar as soon as available at rollins.edu. I also had Kevin as a professor, and aside from remembering his kindness and the eloquence that allowed him to demand from his students and others all that they had, I'll remember the thunderstorm that kept half our class from trudging out to the Fred Stone Theater that day. And when we showed up, sat, wet in the risers, the storm took the lights. After mocking gasps and exasperation, the silence and darkness invited from Kevin the opening bars of the song he sang for thousands, which you will now hear in full.
Nighttime sharpens, heightens each sensation. Darkness stirs and wakes imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defenses. So its splendor, grasp it, sense it, tremulous and tender. Turn your face away from the garish light of day. Turn your thoughts away from cold, unfeeling light. And listen to the music of the night. Close your eyes and surrender to your darkest dreams. Purge your thoughts of the life you knew before. Close your eyes, let your spirit start to soar. And you'll live as you've possess you. Open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind in this darkness which you know you cannot fight. The darkness of the music of the night. Let your mind start a journey through a strange new world. Leave all thoughts of the world you knew before. Let your soul take you where you long to be. Only then can you
shared with you last week our trivia question regarding the statues that appeared on campus. One of a fox that we still remember on Fox Day. The other of one that represented a women's society that now no longer exists. The men's society that the fox represented also no longer exists. But the answer to what animal represented that women's society was a cat.
Cat!
We did have a correct answer. And as for the history, in January 1934, Hamilton Holt, who served as Rollins president from 1925 to 1949, was gifted statues of a fox and cat from Senator Murray Sams. And these statues were permanently placed on the walkway of Rec Hall, the structure that the pool has since replaced. And inspired by the two statues, Holt founded a cat society for women and a fox society for men. According to Rollins archives, these societies were exclusive groups made up of four women and four men each, elected by an annual vote of the student body. The women elected the foxes, the men elected the cats. These privileged members were the only people permitted to touch the statues, but occasionally the fox and cat were taken and hidden as practical jokes. The year 1949 was tragic because the cat statue was smashed beyond repair, and to this day, the crime remains unsolved.
Ooh.
President Hamilton Holt had admired these pieces for years. In 1929, he wrote to his friend that they have long appealed to my antique sense, and he believed they would be fittingly enshrined at Rollins. I think that's all the best information we have. And more history of the statues and Fox Day may be found at rollins.edu/Fox Day.
That's so fun. It's interesting because I was looking at some of the old yearbooks. I don't know if there's a name for the building over in the Park Ave area over there. I can't think of it. It escapes me at the moment. Anyway, when I was over there, and so I saw, like, you know, various photos and images of, and then I thought it was interesting, but I didn't know much more beyond that. So that's kind of fun to learn. And I did read in one of the yearbooks that, as you know, Fox Day will eventually be coming upon us here in like a month or so. But, mm-hmm. I remember reading that in anticipation for, I think it was in the 70s, some students made their own like faux fox.
Yes.
That's so funny to me.
This was actually in a year when Fox Day was no more.
Oh, that's right.
Because it did have a hiatus, but was
for a window of time.
Introduced to the campus in 79 by Thaddeus Seymour.
Yep.
Yay,
our president
Thaddeus.
At the time.
Gotta love the bow tie.
Who, it's very funny, he has commented on a lot of these articles that are on Rollins.edu about the fox and the cat. And he is actually the person who's responsible for Fox Day being back.
Thank you so much.
After it was originally instituted by President McKean, I think was in the 50s.
That's so fun.
So, good work from our listener who won our Gertzberg gift card.
Delicious.
And I will now be putting up this week's question as we speak.
As you do that, I do want to pay my respects. I had Professor Hemingway as well. And yeah, this is heart-wrenching to hear. I had him for singing and acting with Dr. Julia Foster, so I'm sure, you know, she's crushed as well to hear this, because, you know, they worked together doing that class, and all those students who had it with me, I know, would agree it was a phenomenal experience, and life-altering, at least for me, for sure. Just a gentle, hilarious, wonderful man. I learned so much and enjoyed the class thoroughly. I know he taught us, you know, Meisner and all that good stuff. And I remembered that he enjoyed basketball a lot. So, yeah, but, this is definitely a tragedy and a loss. And it reminds us of, you know, frailty and to enjoy each moment. Because, you know, it's just, life can be like a vapor, but he lived a full life as long as we did have him. And I was thankful to have that blessing to be a part and be in a class that he taught. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks. And so right now you'll find on this, facebook.com/thesanspur our new question. The question is, the manuscript of what Jack Kerouac novel, written entirely on one roll of teletype paper, is housed in Rollins' archives?
Cool. Good question.
Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a writing house affiliated with him.
That is where he wrote the novel.
Nice.
Yes. Over in College Park on Cloisier Street.
Yep. It's by the museums and such.
Yes. He lived in the back half of a home that he rented out with his mother for a time. And that is where he wrote this novel. I don't believe he did any other significant writing there, but his writing room was accessible through the bathroom, which gave him
otherwise known as the office for some people.
Which gave him the nickname the Latrine Laureate, which was somewhat degrading because Truman Capote did not consider him a writer. He considered him a typer, as but history does remember both of them well, so all's well that ends well. Anybody?
Yes. Precisely.
But we will learn what that novel was and a little bit more about the Kerouac House and their place in Orlando next week.
Very cool. Yeah, I know you could fly to and be selected, I guess, to be a part. So that's cool.
Yes. That is also a cool thing that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And next week, upcoming in the Sanspur, there will be a little bit more about Kevin Gray from students who have had him, as well as all your favorite writers and artists will be there.
I mean, yes, it'll be wonderful. Another issue. We'll probably be talking a little bit more about the Oscars, you know, a little bit about the winners and all that good stuff.
Yes. Awesome. I did want to say I love the cover. Thank you for whoever designed that. That's great, Ryan Gosling. I loved it. It was hilarious. I mean, I talked about it with multiple people. And if you didn't see it, it says, "Hey, girl, sorry you lost your I card. You can have my V card." So great.
Gotta love that Ryan Gosling.
Right?
So and good.
Those issues are still available around campus. If you are looking for them, popular spots include in front of Olin Library, in the CSS building. Where do you pick up your sands, Boromir?
Me? Ooh, I actually pick it in my residence hall, Pinehurst.
Convenient.
P Hut. What?
Convenient P.
So that always helps. That always helps.
Nice.
Sometimes I even go to the campus center, grab a meal. So, you know, those are my hot spots.
Mm-hmm.
Good deal. And for the three of us, we wish you a great week.
Mm-hmm. See you guys.
Bye, everyone.
See ya.